Citizen Sounds, a diverse collection of sounds and stories from our researchers, educators, and students, sharing knowledge and insight to make a difference in Leicester and the world. We are Citizens of Change, University of Leicester. Welcome back to the second part of our podcast with Ken Pounds. So I know that you had other collaborations going on. So with Japan and so presumably JAXA, which is the Japanese.
Yes, well, ExoSat finally ended its life. I think it ran out of control gas for the pointing in 86 after three very successful years. Fortunately for us, both in Germany and in Japan, there were ambitions to have national X-ray astronomy projects. We would have loved to have had a national British X-ray astronomy project and had lots of bright ideas, but there wasn't the money. So we were fortunate, I think, to be approached by both the Max Planck Institute in Germany to have some involvement in what became ROSAT, the Röntgen satellite, which was what their satellite became when it was launched in 1990. But before then, in a collaboration with JAXA, the Japanese Space Institute, in a satellite called Ginga, where we were invited to provide the main detector. Ginga turned out to be a really interesting mission. Working with the Japanese was very rewarding, I mean, and very efficient. There were other aspects of Ginga that were very good experience, right back from the how it came about in the first place. I don't know the origins of this, but there was some discussion between the SERC in the UK and the Japanese science agencies about collaborating in space. And the outcome of that was that a small delegation consisting of the Director of Astronomy, Space and Radio at SERC, Harry Atkinson, John Horton, who was head of space at Rutherford Lab, and then shortly after that, atmospheric physics at Oxford, and I all went over there to talk about what this collaborative space project might be. And so it turned out after the visit that what they wanted was a collaboration in an X-ray project. So Ginga was the outcome of that. A really good project, which was later identified on one occasion at least as being the most successful joint Japanese-British science collaboration of that period. For us, it was good in that it gave us direct access with a healthy share of observing time on a highly competitive satellite, which over a period, because of the large detector that it was carrying, was as good as anything around. Plus the fact that there was an exchange of students between Leicester and Tokyo that was very healthy. And I think quite a few young people, you know, enjoyed that opportunity. And that, together with our involvement in ROSAT, where we, the UK, offered an ancillary telescope to look at very long wavelength X-rays, or in fact, far ultraviolet. That was called the UK Wide Field Camera. That was also really productive, and we, I think, discovered the first few hundred of these far ultraviolet sources, mainly stars, so not quite as dramatic as, you know, black holes and all of that. And those projects together covered this big gap that I mentioned earlier in the NASA program. So NASA were up and ready to go eventually in 1999 when they launched this great big observatory in space that was then called Chandra after the American Indian astrophysicist Chandrasekhar. A few months later, happily for us, ESA launched its successor to ExoSat, which was another X-ray observatory with even bigger telescopes, not sufficiently high resolution, but ideal for my interests at least, into orbit also in 1999. And that really takes us into the modern era because the X-ray astronomy for the subsequent 20 years has been dominated by Chandra and XMM Newton, as it was called, in orbit.
So 1999, you get this start of the era of these really large X-ray observatories. So what are they doing and what are the discoveries that are coming out of those?
Let's talk mainly about XMM Newton. So we had a significant involvement, as is the Leicester tradition, basically, in the hardware of missions that we then helped to exploit, and has been highly productive. I mean, one measure of that, in a sort of stamp collecting measure, is that we can see the way in which, in the rocket era, we had about 30 cosmic sources. In the small satellite era of Uhuru and Ariel 5, we had a few hundred. The latest count from XMM is something like 500,000 X-ray sources in a relatively small fraction of the sky that have been looked at with these high-focus telescopes. So basically, we're seeing a source density that corresponds to many billions of X-ray sources around the sky that are visible with telescopes that are a million times more sensitive than the rocket equipment that we used way back in the 1960s. So the subject numerically has expanded enormously. But I think the main impact in terms of astrophysics and what we know about the objects out there in the universe results from the ability with these two big observatories to just sit and look at an individual object, maybe for hours or for days, and get high quality X-ray spectra, which we can do now in that we've replaced the proportional counters with X-ray CCD cameras, which have got 10 times better spectral resolution. Basically, I think you could summarize the situation now by saying that X-ray astronomy is on a par with ground-based optical and radio astronomy in terms of the quality of data that we get. Sometimes X-ray astronomy is said to be, you know, the study of the hot and violent universe. And to some extent, that's right, and that's what we're actually seeing. Although with the power of a telescope like those on XMM Newton, we can actually now see at last these normal stars. So the normal stars like the Sun that we, you know, were a long way from seeing way back in the skylight days, we can now see. So the whole sky basically can now be observed with these modern telescopes.
So space science at Leicester has obviously really expanded whilst you've been there. So what are some of the other big projects that are going on at Leicester now?
Yes, that's true. In the X-ray astronomy group, we had everything to ourselves until the mid-70s, when the department hired Professor Llewellyn Jones from the Rutherford Lab. He's an Earth observation scientist, and he basically introduced this new theme, which is now a major part of what we do in the university, Earth observation science. And then 10 years later, we also hired one of the stars from Imperial College, Stan Cowley, who is still there. And he was the one that really brought planetary science to the university. So I think there are three big elements now on the scientific side of what we do at Leicester. There is still high energy astrophysics, which is another name for X-ray astronomy. Planetary science, which includes a big involvement in an ESA mission on Jupiter's moons, and Earth observation science. So we got now three strings to our bow now at the university.
So what's been some of the impact of your research, some of the wider benefits that have come out of space research at Leicester?
Well, one of the experiences that I occasionally had in days gone by, just chatting to friends in the local, for instance, about other things than sport, which was quite rare, but nevertheless, occasionally I found I had to explain what I actually did for a day job. And you could talk, I found, about black holes for a while, you know, like 5 minutes before you could see people glazing over. And I thought at the time then, well, you know, what a pity that I actually never got involved with research that was of any use to anybody. So the fact that we were able to spin off from the university something like the National Space Centre, which clearly has a very big impact on the local society and more widely than that, what did at least give me a warmer feeling. So the emphasis was on public engagement, which I think has been a great success, you know, with tens of thousands of school kids going through Space Centre every year. And then, of course, most recently, there's the ambition for a space park. At the space park, there now will be the capability to do science, some science linked through the university, public engagement, the nearby National Space Centre, and the ability to design and build small satellites and carry out cutting-edge space research. And we are developing instruments and techniques that have potential elsewhere. So one of the things that I was always quite keen on is to look at where these opportunities might be. And so quite early on, when we realised that if you had an X-ray telescope, there was not much point in taking pictures of the sky on film, because what do you then do with the film? So we initially used a form of gas detectors, but then later, in collaboration with a company in the UK, found that by modifying CCDs, and CCDs are basically the device that in your phone or camera, you know, transforms light into electrons and records an image. What we found was that if we increase the depth of the silicon layer that is in these CCD cameras, we could make them sensitive to X-rays. And so that was done and gave us what we needed for X-ray telescopes. There was a similar development that was going on in America at MIT. But I think we had very competitive CCDs, and in fact, the CCDs on XMM Newton come from this origin in the UK. But of course, they have application elsewhere. So now, if you have a problem with your teeth, with a crack or some issue, then the dentist won't stick a piece of film in your mouth before he irradiates you with X-rays. He'll put a little CCD camera in your mouth. And the advantage there is it gives a result instantaneously. And the dosage that your body has to take from the X-rays is much less, because CCDs are very sensitive. So that was an early example of a kind of spin-off from what we were doing in space into normal life. And we actually did, and still exists, I think, a small applications group in the Space Research Centre for looking at things like this. Another one is the gamma camera, which is another detector that has been transformed into a portable device that medics can use for looking at the way in which drugs that have been dosed with a small radioactive element can find their way to a tumour. And so you can actually map location of tumours using this gamma camera. So these are examples of spin-off, if you like, from the technology that comes out of doing relatively useless things like looking for black holes.
So it's never been government policy to create a British astronaut corps, though it hasn't stopped us from producing astronauts. So we've had Helen Sharman, obviously our first one in the 1990s, Tim Peake, who's obviously quite famous, who's been on this latest mission on the International Space Station a few years back. Have you ever secretly wanted to be an astronaut?
Absolutely not. Sounds to me like a really very dangerous and stomach-churning exercise. But I was active years ago in, I think, encouraging the UK government to change its policy on human spaceflight. Because going right back to the start, when I was just, particularly with reference to people like Harry Massey, quite rightly, he and other people running UK space science at the time in the 60s and 70s realised that we in the UK could not afford to compete with the Soviet Union and the United States in human spaceflight. So big rockets and human spaceflight really were left to others. But I think it was a secretary at the Royal Astronomical Society, Paul Murdin, a fellow astronomer, who started to make the argument in the 1980s that maybe this policy should be reconsidered. And the Royal Astronomical Society set up a commission. There were three of us on it, and I was the one with experience in space science. And I was actually quite positive by then on the grounds of the public engagement, really, in space. And so we sat and talked and went around and met people. And I think began by focusing on the scientific potential of going back to the moon. The Apollo program had been and gone, and I think it's not unfair to say that they'd scratched at the surface of the moon. They'd brought back some very interesting samples. But there was a whole history of the solar system sitting there in the several meters of lunar regolith that was to be discovered. One of the people that we were impressed with, I remember, was Ian Crawford, who's professor at Birkbeck, now at UCL, whose subject is the moon. And so I was really quite taken by the scientific potential of going back to the moon with professional geologists, if you like, to dig into the lunar regolith and really see what it was made of, what evidence there might have been for previous events, collisions, asteroids, comets, and, you know, solar outbursts and all of that hidden there from view. So I was quite taken with that, but always had in mind that if we could actually get the Brits involved and have, you know, a British man or woman in space, there was the additional potential in terms of public engagement. So anyway, we made a positive report on that, obviously mentioning that beyond the moon, of course, more ambitious things could then follow, the Mars and asteroids and all of that. I think that really did begin to change the discussion. And not too long after that, the UK actually did change its attitude. And again, I think considering mainly working through Europe, because already there was a human spaceflight program in Europe. And it was agreed that the UK should join that and we would pay a contribution to the programme. And as a reward, we would get our own British astronaut, which of course then actually happened.
Is there a question in your field that you would love to know the answer to? I mean, there's probably several of them, but is there one in particular that you would love to know the answer to?
Well, in thinking about subjects like this, particularly in terms of exploration of the galaxy and all of that, I suppose most humans are intrigued by the question, are we alone? And I'm no different from anybody else. I think that realistically, we're not alone in the sense that we're not unique, certainly not in the universe and probably not in the galaxy. There will be other advanced civilizations. On grounds of probability, some more advanced than we are. We're in a solar system that's been around 4.5 billion years. The galaxy's been around for quite a lot longer than that. So there will be, undoubtedly, I think, just on grounds of statistics, there will be other advanced civilizations. So the question is, why have they never said hello? What are the chances that we will make contact? I think the limitations now remain for the moment that the galaxy is a big place and the fastest signals that we know that allow us to make contact are the speed of light, and to get from one side of the Milky Way galaxy to the other is tens of thousands of years. So what we'll need, I think, to make contact is to find that there is an advanced civilization that is interested in discussing with us. Might not be the case, of course. I mean, they may see us as being not interesting enough, but which in any case is within a few light years away, so we can have a conversation that won't take more than a lifetime. So I think that has to remain one of the real fascinations. And the first indications will probably not come through a direct conversation, but in some kind of understandable signals that will be obvious are coming from an intelligent source. So I'd have thought it was a good chance during the lifetime of my youngest grandchild, who is now one, that, you know, we'll make contact and hopefully they'll be friendly.
So I've heard rumours of a Lester Space Mafia around the world. So tell me about this.
It was always a team effort. You know, from the very beginning, what we were doing in designing and launching Skylark rockets and aerial satellites and so on was the result of a team of almost always young, enthusiastic technicians and physicists. And a growing number of those would be research students, because the work that we were doing in X-ray astronomy and during the early days was sufficiently high profile that it attracted good students. And so we were fortunate in getting some really good students to join, do PhDs. And over the years, there have been many dozen of these individuals, quite a lot of whom are now famous and spread around the world. So we do, at least I sometimes do, talk about the Leicester Mafia. And one particular chap, Richard Griffiths, who I mentioned earlier on as the one who first sighted the blip that became our first black hole and then let it slip out of his fingers. He eventually went over to America, worked for NASA, and is now retired, lives in Hawaii. And in his response to our connection recently, he said, in his experience, the camaraderie in the Leicester group was better than he'd ever found anywhere else, you know, which was really nice to hear.
So you've had an extraordinarily successful career. Have you got any advice for someone who is just starting out in, you know, the field of space research?
Well, I don't think I can offer advice in the sense that my career was well planned. I mean, my career was never well planned. It was a series of accidents, really. You know, the fact that at school I chose to be in the science stream rather than the art stream because they were going to have the better football team. I went to UCL rather than King's or Leeds or Manchester because I got into Hall of Residence, few hundred yards from college, which meant I, with lectures starting at 10, I could roll out of bed at 9:30 and still get there for the lecture. You know, then on to, after I graduated, the fact I found myself in a department that was just starting out space research. So I think my advice is really very unhelpful. It would, well, be lucky. Be lucky in where you're going to be at various times in your career. And be ambitious and enjoy it.
Well, I have to say, it has been a real treat speaking with you. Thank you so, so much.
Citizen Sounds, University of Leicester. Visit le.ac.uk.